Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on April 11, 2017. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Fena Sutta. The Fena Sutta likens ignorance and the five clinging aggregates to foam on the water and is another teaching on emptiness as the Buddha taught emptiness, to be empty of ignorance. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace.
Tonight's talk on the Fena Sutta is another talk on emptiness. As most of you know, this past week, I guess, beginning last Tuesday, each talk was on emptiness, a slightly different application. In our Sunday retreat, that was really the theme, and our residential retreat, emptiness is really the theme. But you could really say that the entire Buddha's teaching, emptiness is the theme, in that what he taught, the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path, is a way of emptying ourselves of ignorance. And using emptiness that way, as an action word rather than a noun, as a place to aspire to, really makes the point that it's up to us. We need to take some action. We need to take direct action. And that direct action is framed by the Eightfold Path and the other supportive teachings that the Buddha taught, such as using the metaphor of five clinging aggregates to describe what a self is. And this teaches directly towards that. The Fena Sutta is another sutta on emptiness, as the Buddha uses the term. In this sutta, he teaches the emptiness of the five clinging aggregates and the emptiness of creating self-identities by clinging to fleeting objects, events, views, and ideas. The Buddha teaches the emptiness of perceptions rooted in ignorance, foam on the river or a drop of water, the emptiness of magical teachings, and the ignorance necessary to follow mirages, the futility of following dharmas lacking the true heartwood of his dhamma, and that was a problem even during the Buddha's time. The sutta follows from what the Buddha awakened to, dependent origination, which shows that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths to 12 observable causative links, all manner of confusion, deluded thinking, and ongoing disappointing and unsatisfactory experiences follow. Does everybody understand that, what I just said? I mean, I say it over and over again, that what the Buddha awakened to is basically ignorance of the true nature of reality, meaning as expressed in the Four Noble Truths. And the teachings on dependent origination, though confusing to many, especially at first glance, simply states that, and it gets into the progression from ignorance through these 12 links that ends up in suffering. I don't want to get back into the dependent origination right now. So. The five clinging aggregates are form, feelings, perceptions, mental fabrications, and resulting thinking rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. These five clinging aggregates provide the appearance, the mirage, of the establishment of a substantial and permanent self to a mind ignorant of these truths. Any questions?
Say the five again.
Form, meaning physical form, for one, but also, as it relates to clinging, external physical forms, meaning we create identities over the things that we own, the things that we want, and even the things that we don't like in the physical world. Then feelings, and feelings in this sense is not just a physical or emotional feeling. Feeling is really any disturbance in the mind. Perceptions. Now remember, all of this is rooted in ignorance, so it's perceptions that we form rooted in ignorance. And then the next is fabrication. Form, feeling, perceptions, mental fabrications. And another maybe more easily understood word for fabrications is assumptions. And those assumptions, remember, are rooted in ignorance. And then the last aggregate is our ongoing consciousness. But as I always say, it's not consciousness with a big C. It's not some grand cosmic consciousness that we're all a part of and that we should aspire to. It's consciousness rooted in ignorance. It's ongoing thinking rooted in ignorance. So that mind, as it relates to the Four Noble Truths, unless something intervenes, can only produce further ignorance. Ignorance can't give rise to wisdom unless there's a vehicle for doing that, and that's the Eightfold Path. So thank you for the question. Does that answer the question? Anybody else have any questions about the five clinging aggregates? It's a pretty simple concept, but it's made complicated because of our own conditioned thinking. Anything that challenges the views that we hold of the world is difficult to accept. The modern term for conditioned thinking is confirmation bias. We're biased towards seeing things in a way that confirms our views, no matter how much difficulty we might experience from those views. Hence the first noble truth. There is dukkha in the world. There is ongoing unsatisfactory experience. And the Buddha is not just saying, because we're in the world, there's suffering. That's part of the first noble truth. But then he points out how we contribute to our own confusion, delusion, and suffering through craving for and clinging to wanting things to be different than they are, meaning more of something, less of something, or just a situation that we find upsetting, even though it's occurred, we learn to accept it. And I hope I remember to mention an email I got from one of our online Sangha students that relates to this. If you don't hear me mention it, just remind me if you think about it. I don't want to interrupt the sutta with that. Let me go back a sentence. These five clinging aggregates provide the appearance, the mirage, of the establishment of a substantial and permanent self to a mind ignorant of these truths. These five clinging aggregates are empty of wisdom and understanding. The Buddha's entire teaching is always in the context of Four Noble Truths, to empty oneself of this initial ignorance and to recognize and abandon all self-referential views arising from this initial ignorance. The reference to appropriately or clearly examining or clearly seeing, I'm referring to what I'm going to read in the sutta, the reference to appropriately or clearly examining or clearly seeing impermanent phenomena arising and passing away means observing life unfolding from the refined mindfulness of the framework and guidance of the Eightfold Path, supported by the concentration developed through Shamatha Vipassana meditation. In other words, that the main reason, really the only reason the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path is to provide the framework to recognize and abandon our own conditioned thinking. And that's the reference here to clearly seeing, clearly understanding. The Fena Sutta. The Buddha was staying with the Avajans on the banks of the Ganges River. He addressed those assembled. Friends, suppose a large glob of foam were floating down the river, and a person with good eyesight saw it and clearly examined it. To them it would appear empty, void, without any substance. For what substance could there be in a glob of foam? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any form that is past, future, or present, any form that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without any substance. For what substance could there be in form that is constantly changing? And he's referring to our physical form that we immediately cause an identity about. This is me, and this is always going to be me. Excuse me. And externally, through attaching ourselves to objects, events, views, and ideas, to the physical world. That's the form. And so, if there's impermanence in anything, how can you say that there's a self there? A permanent self. The Buddha's now pointing the minds of his friends that he's speaking to, the gathered Sangha, to start recognizing the ongoing process of living a human life, rather than deciding this is me and this is me with all my needs and desires and it will always be me. I'm fixated in this way. He's pointing out the impermanence beginning with form. He continues. I had my commentary on that. This is in reference to the form aggregate constantly changing is a reference to the three marks of existence. And we talk about anicca, anatta, and dukkha often here. The Buddha continues. Now suppose that in the rainy season it is raining fat, heavy drops, and a water bubble appears and disappears on the water. A person with good eyesight sees this and clearly examines it. The water bubble would appear empty, void, and without substance. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? Again, he's using these metaphors to instruct how we should engage in the world through the clear vision developed through the Eightfold Path, to clearly see the rising and passing away of all of our thoughts, words, and ideas, the arising and passing away of the impermanent physical body, and you can take that from birth to death and everything in between, but also just to be mindful that in each and every moment, even our physical body is constantly in a state of flux. It's always changing. There's always cells dying, and there's always cells being born to support this human body. And in that sense, and it's a very important understanding, even in a physical sense, we are constantly changing. I am a completely different physical being. Well, not completely. I am a different physical being in this moment than I was when I first started talking tonight. Just as much, even though not as substantial, as I was when I was 5 years old to 61. Always changing. How does that relate to the Dhamma? Why is that important? Because it reminds me, and it reminds all of us that practice the Dhamma, that what's most important is to be fully engaged in my life as it unfolds, and to be mindful of that. That's where lasting peace and happiness resides. And not reacting to this five clinging aggregate thing, and just seeing life clearly. Being empty of ignorance. For what substance could there be in a water bubble? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines feelings that are past, future, or present, any feelings that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. Though to those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in feelings that are constantly changing? Does everybody understand that?
And I get the gist that, you know, things are constantly changing, but isn't there substance to things as they change?
It's another good question, Judy. There's no permanent substance.
Okay.
And that is really the important thing.
Yeah.
And if you observe the impermanent nature of all things, thoughts, words, and deeds, internal and external, if you're looking for substance, you would have to say, no, there isn't any. So to answer your question, there's an appearance of substance because of continuity, because this seems like the same body at 61 that I had at 5. But continuity obscures impermanence. Each and every moment of those 55, 56 years, I was always in a state of becoming. Now, when I was deeply rooted in ignorance, what I became was another ignorant person. And I'm not talking about in a general sense. We're not ignorant just because we're human beings. We're ignorant in relation to the Four Noble Truths, unless for some reason we're not. And most human beings are. And that's why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path. It's important to recognize the impermanence of all things, but most importantly, and this is where meditation is so valuable in its practice, the impermanence of every one of my thoughts. And in meditation, as we start to deepen our concentration and create a little bit of space between thoughts, we cease clinging one thought immediately to the next thought. That's what people refer to when they're talking about spaciousness developing in meditation. We're able to actually observe that process. And when we can observe it, when we can understand what we're doing by constantly clinging one self-referential view to the next, we can abandon it. We can interrupt the process. In meditation, every time we recognize that we're caught up in our thoughts and come back to the sensation of breathing, even if it's only for a split second, we're interrupting that process in that split second. And as that spaciousness grows, we're creating a space for reality to settle in, for true mindfulness to arise in that consciousness, in that concentration. And it's in that spaciousness, that interruption between one clinging thought and the next clinging thought, that the Eightfold Path takes hold, that we're able to walk that Eightfold Path. Is that clear? Is that understandable? Because I'm not talking metaphorical now. I'm talking in a very real sense. The Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, so we have a way of recognizing and abandoning our own ignorant thoughts, to empty ourselves of ignorance.
But the actual constant changing can be distressed, even though as a scientist I know things are constantly changing. I mean, your body has millions of reactions every second. That in itself can be disturbing.
If you're clinging to things remaining as they are. Or you're concerned, which is another way of clinging, about something going to happen in the future, which is clinging to a thought construct of how we want something to be. It's still clinging. It's still holding on. That's where tension comes from. That's where suffering comes from. And the release, when the Buddha describes an awakened human being, he doesn't refer to an awakened human being in any mystical or esoteric terms. He said that person is released or unbound from clinging. And specifically clinging to self-referential views, clinging to wanting things to be different than they simply are. So another great question, Judy. Liz.
So what you're saying is that the importance of the meditation is that gives us a break from conditioned mind to actually think about the Eightfold Path and respond from that intelligence.
Yes, boy, good word. And it's not that we should be thinking too much about the Eightfold Path during meditation. It's okay if a thought arises, oh, this seems like right effort, etc. But to remember that meditation is primarily for deepening our concentration, so off our cushions, we can develop the refined mindfulness to hold in mind all eight factors of the Eightfold Path.
Yeah, it's not that it gives us that space to think about the Eightfold Path while we're meditating, but it gives us that information so that in the moment, out in our life, off the cushion, we can stop and say, I can live through this moment in equanimity, in a non-reactive, dispassionate, maybe that's not the right word.
It is the right word.
Dispassionate state.
Yes. And that's the essence of concentration. We're involved in our lives where once there was almost constant distraction and we felt it, we now are able to recognize that we're at least a little bit more well concentrated. And it's from that well concentrated mind that we're able to recollect, which is what mindfulness means, to recollect or to hold in mind, the Eightfold Path or whatever is appropriate at that time. So it might be in this moment I'm concentrated enough to know that the next word out of my mouth is not right speech, and I can hold it back and practice right speech in that moment. Or my action might be a wrong action, and I'm well concentrated enough to catch it. I mean, that's the practical application. That's why we need to deepen concentration. Or I might be in a rather mundane, I'm driving down the road, and it's a beautiful day, but I realize that my thoughts are in the future about an irrational concern. And because I've now developed some concentration, I am able to see that is and come back to what's occurring. That's an aspect of right view, seeing things clearly. That's exactly how this works. Now, the Buddha's teaching in this sutta that if your only experience in life is from this thing called the five clinging aggregates, you are constantly distracted by keeping these aggregates clung together, by keeping this identity, this self-referential view that is metaphorically called five clinging aggregates. And I probably shouldn't say metaphorically because it's not really. It's really practically five clinging aggregates. But if that's my only view of myself, I can't see things clearly. I'm stuck in that distraction. That's why I say often that the Buddha could have nearly said that the first noble truth is there is constant distraction as saying there is constant dukkha. It's just that dukkha is a little bit more refined. But it's the preoccupation with dukkha, about the preoccupation with always getting what makes me feel good and making sure, keeping this hyper-vigilance against anything that might detract from my satisfactory experiences, that keeps us distracted from our life as life occurs. Again, coming right back. Emptiness of clinging, emptiness of ignorance, brings us into the present moment. And again, you know how I was talking about the present moment. The present moment is not something to become fixated on either. It's simply something to enjoy. And we can enjoy it when we don't have the need for things to be different than they are. And that can mean, you hear me say often, we can be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. It doesn't mean that we become automatons or robots and we have no feeling at all. It means that we're able to deeply feel whatever feeling is appropriate for the moment without it needing to be any different. So now I'm going to talk about the email I got today from one of our Sangha members out west. I didn't ask her if I could share this, so I'll just leave her name out of it. But she joined us on last year's retreat. Her mom just passed a couple weeks ago. right at about the time that we were going over the Bhadakarata Sutta, the Sutta on the Auspicious Day, on how important it is to be mindful of life occurring. And what she said in the email was how important it was to hear the sutta, but even more important than that, to hear the Sangha's discussion and what we all said about that, and how that allowed her to be present with what was occurring during the funeral and the whole thing with the family and everything else, even coming up to her mom's death. and to be at peace with less than peaceful mind states. And she said, in her words, it was just a wonderful experience. And we're all a part of that. I mean, one of the reasons why I'm saying that is because of our own practical application of the Dhamma here in this room is able to support another Sangha member nearly 2,000 miles away, maybe even a little more than that. It really is remarkable. But what's most remarkable is what we're talking about, what we're sharing, what we're developing is something a human being developed 2,600 years ago. To me, that's the most remarkable thing. And his teachings are still here. This is what the Buddha said 2,600 years ago that brings this type of understanding. So, thank you for the great questions so far. I'll go back just to one sentence, bring it back into context. For what substance could there be in feelings that are constantly changing? And that's in reference, obviously, to the feeling aggregate. Now suppose, the Buddha continues, now suppose during the hot season a mirage was shimmering. A person with good eyesight sees it and clearly examines it. The mirage appears empty, void, and without substance. For what substance could there be in a mirage that is constantly changing? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any perception that is past, future, or present, any perception that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, it would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in perceptions that are constantly changing? And that's in reference to the perception aggregate. Again, not getting into some big, long explanation of what a perception might be, just saying that our perceptions are like a mirage. We don't have to do anything with them. Let them go. There's nothing of substance there. And again, he's talking to perceptions arising from an ignorant mind. Now, suppose that a person with good eyesight is seeking heartwood. Heartwood is always, in the Pali Canon, heartwood is always in reference to the true Dhamma, the true teachings of the Buddha. Now, suppose that a person with good eyesight is seeking heartwood. In seeking heartwood, they went to a forest with a sharp axe. There they find a large banana tree. They cut it at the root and remove the top. They peel away the outer skin and fail to find even sapwood, to say nothing of finding heartwood. I guess banana trees don't have good wood in them. Having good eyesight, they clearly examine the banana tree, and the tree would appear empty, void, without substance in regard to heartwood. For what substance could there be in a banana tree? In the same way, any practitioner well-versed in the Dhamma observes and appropriately examines any fabrications that are past, future, or present, any feelings that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, fabrications would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in fabrications that are constantly changing? Remember that, and that refers to the fabrication aggregate. Again, the best way to understand fabrications are their assumptions, but assumptions that we've made based on ignorance. And think about that. What substance could there be in those fabrications, those thought constructs, those assumptions about life? And most importantly, the assumption that this thing that has arisen from ignorance is who I am and who I will always be, a permanent self. The Buddha continues, now suppose a magician were to display a magic trick and a person with good eyesight clearly sees the trick. The trick would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in a magic trick? In the same way, any practitioner, well-versed in the Dhamma, observes and appropriately examines any consciousness, remember, thought, an ongoing thought process that is rooted in ignorance, any consciousness that is past, future, or present, any consciousness that is internal or external, obvious or subtle, common or extraordinary, near or far. To those well-versed in the Dhamma, any consciousness would appear empty, void, without substance. For what substance could there be in consciousness that is impermanent and rooted in ignorance of the Four Noble Truths? It's an interesting reference to consciousness in this way, internal, external, obvious, subtle, common or extraordinary. He's pointing out how even during the Buddhist time and certainly during our time, we create thought constructs and we become enamored with our own thought constructs, don't we? I mean, that's the essence of an ego having taken over control, and you create this grandiose view of yourself in relation to the world. That's what he's referring to, but also referring to creating elaborate and mystical thought constructs over what a simple Dhamma should be about. There's nothing extraordinary about what the Buddha taught, except it's a path directly to lasting peace and happiness. It's extraordinary enough. We don't have to add anything to it. So again, that's in reference to the consciousness aggregate. The Buddha continues, seeing these five aggregates clearly, the well-instructed follower of the Dhamma grows disenchanted with form. They grow disenchanted with feelings, disenchanted with perception, disenchanted with fabrication, and disenchanted with thinking rooted in ignorance. They grow disenchanted with the five clinging aggregates. We're going, what the Buddha is pointing out, what I hope I'm pointing out, is because of taking up the Eightfold Path, we're beginning to go to become disenchanted with all of these self-referential views, because we're now understanding where they're taking us, where they're leading us to, that they are creating the tension and the confusion and the deluded thinking in our lives. The Buddha continues. Oh, lost my place. Sorry about that. Disenchanted, they grow dispassionate. Through dispassion, they are released. With release, there is knowledge that they are released from clinging and ignorant views. You understand that you've actually done this. You've accomplished the task. They know that birth is ended. The fully integrated life has been lived. Now, that's often referred to as the holy life has been lived. But again, the Buddha wasn't teaching a religion, and that word, obviously, holy, has some religious connotations. And what he's referring to as the holy life is a life that is well integrated in the Dhamma. The integrated life has been lived, and the path is now complete. They know there will be no more moments rooted in ignorance. He continues, form is like a glob of foam, feeling a bubble, perception is a mirage, fabrication's a banana tree, consciousness a magician's trick. Yeah. Referring to the five clinging aggregates, form is like a glob of foam, feeling a bubble, perception a mirage, fabrication's a banana tree. How's that? Our assumptions are like a banana tree. Consciousness, our ongoing thinking is like a magician's trick. And I think in The Truth of Happiness I have a line in there. I wasn't thinking about the sutta. But the discursive thinking that is rooted in ignorance is like a magician's trick that we're playing on ourselves. We're keeping ourselves stuck in that ignorance by this constant discursive self-referential views. And again, because of conditioned thinking, the Eightfold Path is the path out of that. The Buddha continues, when you observe them and appropriately examine them, like the Buddha's referring to observing the glob of foam or the magician's trick, you're seeing it clearly, you're seeing the five clinging aggregates, the arising and passing away. When you observe them and appropriately examine them, it is clear they are empty, void, and without substance. To anyone who sees them clearly, they are empty of ignorance. Beginning with the body, when seen with profound discernment, as taught by the Buddha, form is rejected, cast aside. When bereft of wrong views, the emptiness of form is seen clearly like a magic trick. In idiots babbling, no substance is found here. A well-informed Dhamma practitioner, their persistence aroused. It's another great line, their persistence aroused. I'm starting to see things clearly. I'm really engaging in right effort now. Their persistence aroused should continually view the aggregates mindful and alert. They should discard greed, aversion, and deluded thinking, the three defilements, and make themselves their own refuge. It's another important line. Develop the Dhamma and become your own refuge. This is a line that the Buddha uses over and over again. Be a refuge unto yourself. And he's not saying that that this is a practice that we develop in isolation. He also teaches the importance of a sangha. But it is up to us to develop awakening. It's similar to the last words that he ever said. Impermanence and decay is relentless. Strive diligently for your own awakening. Be a refuge unto yourself. Make themselves their own refuge and take to the Dhamma as if their hair was on fire in hopes of gaining awakening. I don't have to worry about my hair being on fire, but I still practice pretty
well. That's what happens.
That's the end of the sutta. We're going to go around the room, but I'd like to. Are there any questions directly related to the sutta? No. Okay. Yeah, it really is. And kind of, if you listen to all the talks this week, especially last Tuesday's, which was very, very confusing for most of us, this is on the same subject. but it's a lot more simpler to understand, isn't it? Same thing, though. Ron, good to see you tonight.
Yes, this one was a whole lot more easier to follow than the last one.
Yep. But he's still talking about perceptions, etc., you know, non-perceptions.
This one was, that was a brain twister. I'm enjoying it. My practice is good.
Glad to hear that.
Any news?
Glad you're here. Judy, good to see you tonight. How's your practice going?
Off and on. I realize that when life gets a little crazy, I forget to meditate, which is when I should be meditating. So, my husband lost his job yesterday. So I was calm, and I just went and started looking at health insurance. but we've been through this drill now so many times where I lose, he lose, since 2010, and after the recession, it's just been one job after another. It's so, you know, we're just not going to freak out about it. It's the way it is now. We don't like it, but it's the way it is.
Yeah.
And I have released the clinging desire for a new kitchen once again. Kitchen's falling apart. Anyway, just Thursday they're coming out to do the estimates because we were doing, I'm releasing the kitchen.
You're describing being at peace with a less than peaceful mind state. That's beautiful. Developing the Dhamma doesn't mean that dukkha never occurs. It just means that it's not going to bother us. And that losing your job, not getting the kitchen when you want, that's all part of the unsatisfactory experience that everyone goes through in life. Dukkha occurs. You know, you'd think that why was that so important to make it the first noble truth? Well, it's because we don't want to face that fact. We don't want to accept it. And the Buddha's saying that's just part of life. Get over it. So I'm glad you got over it. How's your son doing? I don't want to forget to ask you.
We are trying to come up with a way of helping him. We realize him just looking for a job, nothing's going to happen because he doesn't. We're going to try thinking of places that would be good for him and get him to meet the people involved. He would be like a good docent somewhere for a historical organization or some people we might know in ShopRite. Get him to meet the people there, you know, wherever it is, just to get him back out more because he's been withdrawing more. And I keep telling him to call you. And he likes you. I mean, he liked your meeting. So I'm trying to get him to put that on a weekly schedule with you, but he still hasn't done it.
He will.
Yeah,
I hope.
He will. Great. We're trying to, now my husband will have plenty of time to help him develop a plan.
Yeah. I'm glad you made it tonight. Mary, good to see you.
Good to be here. I've never been rigor with my practice, but my the incorporation of this into my daily life is fairly quick in terms of good outcomes and watching life unfold and all of that, having given up a lot of thoughts, feelings, mental fabrications, you know, that's validated every day that I'm moving in the right direction. So it's all good.
Yeah, good for you. Thank you. Keith, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. My practice is going well. A few things you said tonight. We started with Drew before class talking about the eye exam and then your many references to a person with good vision. and the self-referential identity. This year, I had to also go for my first eye exam and being the guy that always identified, you know, I was the guy that didn't have glasses. I had great vision. I now have glasses. So I had to let go of that, you know, identity of being that person. It's fine. It's not anything. It's not a big deal. It's just life.
It's just life.
So, but yeah, I'm thankful to be here and it's a good class.
Glad you're here. Drew, it's good to see you again. How have you been?
Good to see you. wealth, practice could always be a little more stringent. Appreciate the reading. I have a question about it that's related to my own recent experience. I did make a change in my career, one way or another. Well, have to, but I could. I feel motivated to in some way. The idea of impermanence, everything being impermanent, consciousness itself being impermanent, to me always lends itself to these nihilistic ideas. The pyramids are going to turn to sand anyway, so why bother? Ignorance itself is impermanent. Consciousness is. So why even address it? And in my field, in human service, I potentially could help more people than I do currently by advancing my career. And it occurred to me during the reading, what about the Buddha's experience? Do you think motivated him to share his experience?
What a great question. I'm glad I think I have an answer to it. It really was out of intense compassion for everyone that he reached out. Now, I have to go back a little bit to put it all in context. The Buddha was born a prince in his father's kingdom, had everything any human being could ever want, and he could have ascended the throne if he wanted to. At the age of 29, for the first time in his life, he left the palace grounds. And for the first time in his life, he saw the difficulties in life. His father had kept him, what's the right word?
Sheltered.
Sheltered from all of that. And he was so shocked by what he saw, including, but not only, he saw a dead body, and he never saw that before. And it so shocked him that he wanted to understand the nature of suffering. Where does this come from, and is there any way to bring this to an end? And so he wandered around northern India for 6 years, studying with some of the greatest spiritual teachers whose teachings were based on the Vedas, which is the precursor to modern Hinduism, studied advanced meditation techniques. All of those were lacking in developing his understanding. Practiced very, very severe ascetic practices, so much so that it said that he was living on a grain of rice or one bean to sustain himself, because they believe that if you deny your bodily needs, somehow you'll free your mind. That's still practiced today. It's still a philosophy today. Anyway, at 6 years later, at the age of 35, he was walking down a road and passed out and rolled down a little hill into a river. And a young girl, 12 years old, Sujata was his name, pulled him out and nursed him back to health by giving him some rice and milk. And when he had enough strength, he decided that I am going to sit in meditation until I develop understanding. And he remembered a meditation practice that he had done spontaneously as a five-year-old when he was just upset with himself. And he used that meditation method. That meditation method is now called Shamatha Vipassana, what we use today. And he sat in meditation for, the legend is anywhere from one night to 40 days. It doesn't matter. But in his meditation, the metaphor used for his own assumptions that came up during meditation is Mara, the malevolent god Mara, who came after the Buddha in his meditation, and threw these great armies at the Buddha, trying to scare him off his cushion, and wild animals and elephants. Mara sent his three beautiful daughters to try and entice Buddha off his cushion. Of course, this is all metaphor for his own assumptions, his own fears, and his own desires. And in meditation, he recognized every one of those thought constructs as impermanent, not based in any type of permanence. There's nothing here. And as he went through this progression of self-referential assumptions and self-referential views, he finally got to the point where he recognized and let go of every one of them. And that's when he awakened. The legend is that he saw the morning star and he awakened. He became a Buddha. To answer your question, I think I might have gone too far to answer it recently. On one hand, it doesn't matter at all what we do, because everything is like foam on the ocean. And you can take that nihilistic view, and I'm not saying that's part of the Dhamma. We can easily fall into that. That, well, if if nothing is permanent, nothing really matters, I can do anything that I want, which is one of the reasons why people argue for religion, that we need moral and ethical background in our society to keep people in check. Well, it doesn't work all the time anyway. And people will say that about the Dhamma. If we take it too literally, we can say, well, what the hell? I can do anything I want because it really doesn't matter. But then you are ignoring the Eightfold Path. And there's a reason why right speech, right action, and right livelihood is in there, to guide our behavior. And so we recognize when we have craving and clinging thoughts, words, and deeds that are going to lead us astray, create more suffering for ourselves and for other people. So when we incorporate the entirety of the Eightfold Path in our life, and we're at a point in our life when we're thinking about changing a career, but we've developed at least a foundation of the Eightfold Path, we can use that to guide us in a certain direction. What might be more appropriate for the way that I think right now, the way that I feel, my understanding of the world. And so I think you concluded that, excuse me for the long answer, was where does compassion guide me? Was a Buddha, what guided the Buddha? And it was that sense of compassion. Going back to the story, when the Buddha finally awakened, he then sat in meditation off and on. It's often portrayed that the Buddha just meditated for his whole life, and he didn't. He lived a life. He meditated for relatively short periods of time in relation to how he lived his life, but he meditated. And so he sat in meditation off and on for another 2 weeks, considering, is it possible to teach ordinary human beings what I now understand? And what he was thinking about, is there a way to get past the common human problem of conditioned thinking? How can I do that? And is it even worth doing? And then there's a tiny little story, another metaphorical story, where this great Brahmin, meaning an awakened spiritual person, came down from the heavens and pleaded with the Buddha that what you know is so important for humanity, you must go out and teach it. Now, of course, again, that's metaphor for what was occurring in his own mind. It was out of this great sense of compassion. Now, think about this. The Buddha already had it. He didn't need to interact with the world at all. He could have just stayed in the forest, stayed in the cave, and been blissfully happy for the rest of his life. But he knew that there was more to life than that. It wasn't just about maintaining a mind state of peace and calm. There was something about being an awakened human being that compelled him to help other human beings. And that's true compassion. So it's often taught that compassion without wisdom can often be hurtful. And we've all seen, and maybe some of us had the experience of having very altruistic intentions that ended up in ways that seemed to be hurtful towards others and maybe even towards ourselves. So the Buddha often taught that if we're going to engage in compassion, we should marry it with wisdom. And there's a lot of that. Just a good example, again, not putting down any particular religion, but the Christian Crusades are a great example of they really felt like they needed to do something to help people. Instead, they hurt an awful lot of people. That's a good example of altruism or compassion without wisdom. But wisdom married with compassion can change the world. And the Buddha, and I think the Buddha changed the world, not entirely, through his Dhamma, through getting off of his cushion and starting his trek, wandering around. For the next 45 years, the Buddha wandered around northern India and southern Nepal. Another side note, one of the things that's remarkable about that is he never left a 400 square mile area of northern India. And yet, 2,600 years ago, and those teachings are still having an effect today, and affected the society greatly. I could go on and on about the things that changed. So, did I answer your question, what motivated the Buddha?
Yes.
Sorry for the long answer, but I hope it was helpful.
Do you know that I learned today that the flag of Nepal is ringed in blue to denote its peaceful nature?
Hmm. Yeah.
So when you just said that about how it has lasting effect, that has permeated the culture to the point where they put that on their flag.
Oh, it's had an amazing effect. One more quick story. King Ashoka, who was a king in India about 250 to 300 years after the Buddha's death, was probably one of the most bloodthirsty leaders the world has ever seen. Pol Pot, Hitler, they don't even come close to this guy.
What was his name?
His name was Ashoka.
And where, in India?
In northern India, about 250, 300 years after the Buddha's death. That that phrase, head on a pike,
mm-hmm.
he coined that phrase because all over northern India at the time you could see heads on pikes. He was probably one of the first most effective terrorists because that's what he did. He put heads on, he conquered people, villages, towns, cities, great areas, and he put their heads on pikes to show other people what he was capable of. He came across the Buddhist teachings during his kingship, and he took to it immediately, took to it so well that he awakened. And upon his awakening, he never hurt another soul. In fact, he was the first person that started a universal health care program. Anybody that was sick during his time, everybody that got sick was given health care for free, based on his money. I mean, when you're the king, all the money's yours. He went even further than that. It was very common that there was animal sacrifice back then. He started the first free veterinary care in northern India. So that the compassion of the Buddha came through his teachings and changed someone from that extreme violence to being one of the most compassionate leaders the world has ever seen. There's many stories like that. So excuse two of my stories, but they were important, and I like to tell them. Joe, it's good to see you.
That was good.
Yeah. Still struggling with that today. Joe, it's good to see you.
I second nihilistic thinking. I'm sitting, my mind is very noisy, just sitting through it, but sometimes Shamatha's there and Spasa's not. Mostly it's not.
Yeah, but that's part of the practice. And again, the more you and vipassana is not something that we should be looking for on our cushions, and it doesn't necessarily arise. It's off our cushions and within the framework of the Eightfold Path that we gain insight into the impermanence, not self, and dukkha. And
so
that
it's not specifically a component of sitting.
No. No, meditation is primary, and it can be. I'm not saying it shouldn't be. But if we're looking for it, that can lessen the deepening concentration. So it's best to remember that meditation is primarily for deepening our concentration, and it's usually off our cushion that we start gaining insight into the three marks of existence. But that's not to say that you won't have great aha moments while you're sitting in meditation.
What do you do with the space in between thoughts when a thought arises other than put it aside then?
That's it.
So you're not looking to, like, practice Vipassana in that space?
No. Meditation.
Off the cushion.
It can happen on our cushion, but we shouldn't be looking for it. If we start looking for anything during meditation, we're always going to be disappointed and use that disappointment maybe to say, well, this doesn't work for me. Or we're going to become very bored because we're not having constant insights. But if we remember that meditation is primarily for deepening concentration, every single meditation session is effective. Now, you mentioned annihilation, and Drew did too. That's something that many people, when they first start coming to the Dhamma and realizing the implications, but from a conditioned point of view, said, this is annihilation. What's going to happen to me when I let go of all views? The best example and the best description of that is you become Buddha-like, and he lived the most effective life any human being ever lived for 45 more years after his awakening. He certainly wasn't annihilated. And I think some of you that have developed a Dhamma, even Judy was talking about it, you simply become more effective in your life. You're more peaceful. So you don't even gradually annihilate. You become more present in your life the more you develop the Dhamma. And that's easy to recognize as you start deepening.
Yeah, I did in the middle of the night yell out, what is the point? But then I calmed down.
Yeah, well, the point of the Dhamma is to awaken. You know, I mean, that's the point. And if that's what you're after, this is the way to do it. But again, it's not a salvific religion that everybody should or could or will take to it. It was never taught that way. The Buddha never set himself up as a savior. He simply taught a way for human beings that were interested to develop a life of lasting peace and happiness in a very simple and rather direct way. Frank, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here tonight. I have nothing to add. Okay.
I'm glad you're here. How are you, Lorna?
Good, thank you. On this run through of the five clinging aggregates, I think I've realized that it's really all my thinking that I've done up to present. I guess you could say, apart from the practical thinking, where you need to think, you know, to be practical in life and participate in life, but it's everything else. I mean, it's just absolutely everything else. There's nothing that you think about apart from practical things that's outside the five-thing and aggregate. So you can't think of anything that's outside of it. Well, as I see it. So it's kind of just dawned on me this but if you look down the five-thing and aggregates individually, you can say, okay, impermanent, impermanent, impermanent. So that's the hope of it.
That's the point, yeah.
That's the point of it, yeah. There's the hope.
Yep.
But when you think of all your thoughts and emotions and feelings and up till now, and to think that there's been wrong, and it's amazing, really. So anyway, it's kind of just dawned on me, kind of the task of the five-thing aggregates. Maybe I just sort of really dawned on me. I did Qigong with Matt earlier, and I noticed, that, I guess the five-thing aggregates are in my mind, I noticed when I was doing the Qigong, and I mentioned to Matt afterwards, it's the perfect way to get rid of your five-thing aggregates. You know, there's nothing, there's no five clinging aggregates in your mind when you're doing Qigong.
What's Qigong?
If you're doing it effectively. It's a...
if you're doing it mindfully, and as I try to do, so... a little bit of insight there that, that's just doing Qigong. So maybe I'm just like waking up to what my five clinging aggregates really are. And, although it's a kind of like a term out there, and then you suddenly realise that you get a bit more insight what something is, and I think I've sort of taken a big step forward in that sense, and understanding what the five thing is, groups are, and so that's it, really.
Thank you. I mean, that you're completely right in that, and that Qigong, the underlying philosophy is very similar in some ways, not entirely, to what the Buddha taught. And the philosophy underlying, I'll tell you what Tai Chi and Qigong is in just a second. The underlying philosophy between Tai Chi and Qigong is really based on impermanence, and to keep the body in a state, and the mind in a state that is constantly in the flow, to use that word. Lao Tzu, who was a great Chinese master, he said that once you understand the impermanence of all things, you'll let go of everything. Another way of saying, you'll just be in the flow of life. So Tai Chi and Qigong are two similar body movement practices that are rooted in ancient Chinese medicine. It goes back 5,000 years. Very, very effective. I would highly recommend, if you're interested in a body-based type of mindfulness practice, I would highly recommend Tai Chi or Qigong over yoga. And I'm not trying to put yoga down. It's just more effective.
Is, but what's Qigong?
I won't do it justice, but Tai Chi is more of the formal underlying practice, where Qigong gets into more specialized movements themselves.
Okay.
But don't hold me to that. Matt has a lot of good information.
Matt
took a class before meditation. Yeah, on Tuesday nights and Thursday nights, and he's a great teacher. If you're interested. You can get here early. 6 o'clock is class start. Liz, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you too. I don't really have anything to add either, except that I always love the idea that meditation is just to focus on your breathing, and then that brings deeper concentration to your regular life, which now I realize brings that spaciousness to moment-to-moment living, which allows you to use the full path. Just sort of maneuver through life in a more peaceful way.
Yeah.
So,
and isn't that enough? It could be. Thank you, Liz. Bonnie, how are you?
Good. I feel like I'm having some growing pains, some struggles with maybe like Mara coming to teach me some things again. And I just have to remember to be kind as I work through it, to be kind to me, to not feel badly that, you know, you get caught up in stuff sometimes.
Yeah.
Every day is a new opportunity, I guess, to learn.
Yeah, it's great that you recognize that, though. You know, it's not just this. It's not just about, you know, I'm just going to do this and I'll be following my bliss and everything will be wonderful. That's not realistic, and it doesn't reflect well on the First Noble Truth, does it? Even during Dhamma practice, as we're developing an understanding, dukkha occurs. And even afterwards, dukkha occurs. It doesn't mean we become heartless or foolish or anything. You know, when the Buddha heard his dad was dying, he didn't say, I'm just going to meditate. He got up off his cushion and walked 140 miles so he could be of comfort to his dad before he passed. Thank you all. Very good class. There was something else I wanted to say about this, but... our retreat's coming up in 1 month, so if you haven't signed up and you're going to join us, please do so as soon as you can, just to help the logistics. Of course, you can sign up at the last minute, but and we had a great time last year in our last... I think this is our fifth or sixth retreat. There's info on the website. Something in the back of my mind to say, but I can't think of it. I guess I said enough tonight, huh? So we'll finish with the, as we always do, with metta. Pardon me?
With the Karaniya Metta?
The Karaniya Metta Sutta. I guess it was just that there's, I think you all know, there's a Thursday class here now, too. 7:15, yep. And Matt does teach Tai Chi before. So find your relaxed meditative posture and gently close your eyes and gently close your mouth. And again, take a moment to become mindful of the sensation of breathing in your bodies and let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk tonight. And metta is both an aspiration for those of us developing the Eightfold Path and an expression of a fully awakened, fully mature human being. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied. Unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class. Peace.
Thank you for listening. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for guided meditations and instruction and Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos. We rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Please feel free to contact me through crossrivermeditation.com. Peace.